Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We are going to start in the Hollywood section. It's Golden Globes season, so we'll have a couple articles about that. We're going to check in on the royals, and there's some other royals that we don't usually talk about. And then we're going to go to the politics section and finish up there as usual. Our first article is in the Hollywood section, why a Golden Globe win matters more than ever. Several of this year's acting races are so competitive that one major acceptance speech moment could make all the difference for the Oscars. This is by Rebecca Ford on January 8th. When Fernanda Torres took the stage at the 2025 Golden Globes to accept the award for Best Actress in a Drama, you could feel the award season tides shifting beneath the audience's stiletto-clad feet. The Brazilian actor suddenly became a real contender for an Oscar nomination, and anyone who had yet to see I'm Still Here subsequently rushed out to watch it. Sure enough, Torres made history later that month as just the second Brazilian woman ever nominated for an acting Oscar. Although that Globe win wasn't the only reason Torres was able to land her Academy Awards nod, her emotional acceptance speech, complete with her voice cracking when she mentioned her mother, Fernanda Montenegro, who had been nominated in the same category for Central Station 26 years earlier, caught the attention of the voters in that ballroom, as well as those tuning in on TV. The 2026 Golden Globes could prove to be a similarly vital launching pad for several Oscar hopefuls contending in very tight acting races this year. As we discuss this week's episode of Little Gold Men, the lead actor race is especially cutthroat, with two of the frontrunners, Marty Supreme's Timothée Chalamet and One Battle After Another's Leonardo DiCaprio, both nominated in the lead actor in a musical or comedy category. Another win for Chalamet, who won over DiCaprio at the Critics' Choice Awards last weekend, could push him ahead. But what happens in the lead actor in a drama category might be even more interesting. Sinners star Michael B. Jordan, The Secret Agents Wagner Moura, and Train Dreams Joel Edgerton all have a real shot, and each could use their moment on stage to remind voters about their incredible work just ahead of Oscar voting. While Best Actress in a Drama feels locked up for Hamnet star and category frontrunner Jessie Buckley, the Best Actress in a Musical or Comedy category could be more volatile. Rose Byrne has been gaining momentum for her performance in If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, but there's a chance Chase Infinity could land her first major award here because the love for One Battle After Another is so strong. Giving Infinity a big moment on stage could help her in her race for the Best Actress Oscar nomination as well. The supporting categories have all had a lot of heat on them this year. It's possible that One Battle After Another stars Benicio del Toro and Teyana Taylor both win, but Frankenstein's Jacob Elordi is fresh off his victory at the Critics' Choice Awards and has a shot here as well. A Globe win might make him a frontrunner for the Oscars, and Amy Madigan has been earning lots of love for her work in Weapons, so there's a path for her to win at the Globes too. The Little Gold Men team break down all these tight races and the importance of the Globes on this week's episode, which you can listen to by clicking the link on vanityfair.com. This next article, we talked about this show on our last episode of Vanity Fair, why heated rivalry didn't get Golden Globes nominations. We love it, you love it, but Connor Story and Hudson Williams' hit hockey romance won't be getting Golden Globes or Emmys love fans yearn for, at least not yet. This is by Casey Wickman on January 11th. Heated rivalry, the surprise smash hit queer hockey romance that has fans in a chokehold since it skated into the world in late November, has won kajillions of hearts. Connor Story and Hudson Williams are even set to take the stage at the Golden Globes 2026 Sunday night to present an award, and Story recently co-presented the nominees for the upcoming Actor Awards. But unfortunately for fans, the show itself will not get any Golden Globes or any Primetime Emmy Awards in September. Shane Hollander, you get a Stanley Cup. So do you, Ilya Razanov. But sorry, Story and Williams, no Globes or Emmys for you, and not for you either, showrunner Jacob Tierney. And for this, we can blame Canada. The show's status as a purely Canadian production is throwing a wrench into the Golden Globes and Emmy Awards recognition for heated rivalry. Though U.S.-based fans streamed the show on HBO Max, HBO Max did not produce the series. Heated Rivalry was instead entirely produced and financed by Canadian companies. According to the official Globe's eligibility rules, foreign programs, programs produced principally outside the United States, are not eligible for television awards unless they are the result of a co-production, both financially and creatively, between a United States partner and a foreign partner, which precedes the completion of production of the program. Heated Rivalry does not meet that criteria. The Television Academy, the governing body behind the Emmys, has a similar rule. Foreign television is ineligible unless it is the result of a co-production, both financially and creatively, between U.S. and foreign partners, which precedes the start of production, its rule states. But Heated Rivalry and the 9 pounds of clappable material that Williams gained during filming was produced in the spring, while HBO Max signed their deal with Canada's Crave in November, just before the series premiered. This means that the show's first season was not eligible at the Globes and will only be eligible in international categories for the upcoming Emmys cycle. And we hate to break it to you, but those categories are not televised, meaning the world will be denied charming interactions between the two co-stars should they win. The Television Academy did announce a handful of rule changes on Friday, though they did not include "Let the Gay Hockey Boys Win, Damn It." And before we point to prior Canadian Emmy darlings Orphan Black and Schitt's Creek, they both had U.S. production companies on board while shooting. Heated Rivalry has already been renewed for a second season, with stars Story and Williams on contract for 3 possible seasons. We love that what Tierney has done with the place, but maybe there's a way for HBO Max to get a little more involved and change the award's momentum for later seasons. Only time will tell. Our next headline, the AFI Awards bring Timothée Chalamet and Leonardo DiCaprio together again. Steven Spielberg, George Clooney, Ariana Grande, and more also attended the star-studded event, honoring the year's best work. This is by Rebecca Ford on January 9th. The American Film Institute Awards luncheon, honoring the top 10 films and TV shows of the year, kicked off a busy awards weekend that will wrap up with Sunday night's Golden Globe Awards. But every year, the AFI luncheon stands out to those in the room because there are no losers. All of the invitees are there to represent movies and TV shows that were already named in the best of 2025. There are no acceptance speeches either, just a warm lunch and some inspiring words, as well as montages from films and TV shows. "This is so nice. It's my favorite. It's so chill," one film producer could be heard telling another guest. This year's film's honorees were Avatar, Fire and Ash, Begonia, Frankenstein, Hamnet, J. Kelly, Mari Supreme, One Battle After Another, Sinners, Train Dreams, and Wicked for Good. And the TV honorees were Adolescence, Andor, Death by Lightning, The Diplomat, The Lowdown, The Pit, Pluribus, Severance, The Studio, and Task. It Was Just an Accident by Jafar Panahi was also honored with the special award, bestowed on a film that doesn't meet the requirements to be considered for the top 10 list. The event is always a starry affair, but this year's batch of talent was particularly A-list. The biggest names in Hollywood mingled with the most powerful executives in town in the ballroom at the Four Seasons Hotel. Leonardo DiCaprio jumped out of his chair to greet arguably the biggest celebrity in the room, Apple's Tim Cook. Cook, not often present at Hollywood events, was surrounded by big names who wanted to say hello as he attended in support of Apple's big show, including Severance and The Studio. Along with Cook and DiCaprio, the other most famous face in the room was Steven Spielberg, who attended as a producer on Hamnet. When a montage of films was shown during the event and Jaws made an appearance, the entire ballroom broke out into applause, knowing the iconic director was in the room. Just a passing glance at the long line of talent waiting to take photos would give you a sense of the scope. Wicked's Ariana Grande waiting patiently behind Mardi Supreme's Gwyneth Paltrow and One Battle After Another breakout Chase Infinity. The Studio's Seth Rogen following Grande onto the red carpet cracked a joke for producers, apologizing for being a disappointment after the glamour of Grande. "Sorry guys, it's a real step down." The chatter in the ballroom is always boisterous, with stars from film and TV trekking across to greet each other. Emma Stone introduced Grande to her Begonia director, Yorgos Lanthimos. Train Dream star Joel Edgerton chatted with Severance star Trammell Tillman. J. Kelly star George Clooney joked with Netflix's Ted Sarandos about not wanting to be in the background of other photos while briskly moving through the crowded ballroom. Paltrow ran into her Great Expectations co-star and longtime friend Ethan Hawke, and Michael B. Jordan and Sinners director Ryan Coogler caught up with Marty Supreme director Josh Safdie. One battle after another star, Tiana Taylor, warmly embraced Frankenstein's Jacob Elordi. Andor's Diego Luna ran up to his good friend Guillermo del Toro. And there was a Breaking Bad universe reunion when Jesse Plemons, here for Begonia, ran into Vince Gilligan and Rhea Seehorn, who were at the event with their new show, Pluribus. Universal's Donna Langley and Warner Brothers' Michael DeLuca and Pamela Abdi rubbed elbows with the crowd. Last to slip into the room was Timothée Chalamet, skipping the carpet but making it in time to join the Marty Supreme table, seated next to his co-star, Odessa Azion. AFI President and CEO Bob Gazzal's opening remarks referenced the heaviness of this time in the world, but also highlighted the importance of storytelling. "Our hearts are breaking, every day it seems, on the hour," he says. "With so much loss, why are we celebrating today? Because we need you. Because we need your stories to help us make sense of emotions that we cannot escape, nor should we escape them." After clips of the honored films were shared, the feel-good event wrapped with a brief speech from Carol Burnett, who reminisced about her lifelong love of storytelling. "I never lost the deep respect and love that I have for all the stories we tell through cinema and television. Creative collaboration has always remained at the heart of our work," she said. "The world is a better place for having heard your voices." We're moving to the royals section. Our first headline, Philippe Jeannot, first husband of Princess Caroline of Monaco, dies at 85. The businessman was known for his playboy ways, then became a member of the royal family of Monaco during his brief marriage to Princess Caroline. This is by Monica Coviello on January 9th. Philippe Jeannot, the first husband of Princess Caroline of Monaco, has died in Madrid, where he lived at the age of 85. His eldest daughter, Victoria, shared the news of his passing on Thursday, January 8th, via social media. "It is with immense sadness that I announce the death of my father," she wrote in a caption with a carousel of photos of Jeannot. "He departed this side of the world peacefully surrounded by family on January 8th, 2026 in Madrid, after a long, beautiful, adventurous life. A grandfather of three, almost four. To my legendary papa, oh, how we love you. We will miss you. No adequate words." She went on to thank her deceased father for all the laughs and adventures, showing us your world and the inspiration to reach greater heights, as well as for your love, which will never leave us. Philippe Jeannot was the son of Congressman Michael Jeannot and was a descendant from a family associated with French nobility. Sorry, that's Michel Jeannot. An entrepreneur and a man of unquestionable charm, he was often the spotlight, even before becoming a part of the royal family of Monaco. Jeannot had four children, Victoria, Isabel, and Alexis, born of his 1987 marriage to Danish model and socialite Nina Wendelbo Larsen. They divorced in 1997, as well as Chloe, who's 20, whom he shares with his current partner, Swedish model Helene Wendel. The most famous chapter in Jeannot's life, however, remains his brief marriage to Princess Caroline. In 1978, Caroline was 21 years old and already drawing plenty of international attention. She announced that she would marry Philippe Jeannot despite the doubts of her parents, Prince Rainier and Princess Grace, who considered him common, as well as skepticism from the press. Jeannot, 17 years her senior, was perceived as a Don Juan, entangled in shady affairs, but for the young princess, love evidently overcame all misgivings. The two were married in a civil ceremony on the Rocher de Monaco on June 28, 1978, followed by the religious ceremony the next day, all just a few months after the couple met at a nightclub. They honeymooned in Tahiti, their every move chronicled by the press. Despite the harmony of the early days of their marriage, Jeannot soon returned to his playboy ways, and photos of Jeannot and another woman in America reached Caroline. The marriage lasted just 2 years. Caroline filed for divorce on October 1980. In 1992, Pope John Paul II annulled the marriage within the Catholic Church, which does not allow divorce, citing insufficient consent and making the marriage as if it never happened, in the Church's view. Caroline first petitioned for the annulment in 1982. In 1983, she married Stefano Kasaragi in a civil ceremony. While the church was still considering her case, Caroline and Kasaragi had three children, Andrea, Charlotte, and Pierre, before he died in a speedboat crash in 1990. Our next headline in the royal section, Kate Middleton celebrates her birthday with an emotional video about healing. Deeply grateful. Instead of her traditional birthday portrait, the Princess of Wales chose to share a video full of nature to celebrate her 44th birthday. This is by Valentin Uglu-Servant on January 9th. To celebrate her 44th birthday, Kate Middleton has chosen to honor Mother Nature. This Friday, January 9th, the Princess Wales shared a personal video in which she celebrated the healing power of nature. The video is the fourth and final installment of her Mother Nature series. Each season, she's made a habit of sharing her feelings and thoughts, encouraging those who follow her on her social networks to cherish their connection with the natural world. In this highly symbolic new episode, she appears on screen several times. We see her walking alone in frosty wooded landscapes, enjoying the view, a ray of sunshine, and running her hand through the water of a river, looking tranquil. In the shots, she's dressed in a long olive green coat and accessorized with a newsboy cap. Even in the coldest, darkest season, winter has a way of bringing us stillness, patience, and quiet consideration, she says in a voiceover. Where the stream slows just enough for us to see our own reflection, to discover the deepest parts of ourselves, alongside the whispers and the pulse of every living thing. I find myself reflecting on how deeply grateful I am. For the rivers within us flow with ease, fears washed away, cleanse and purify. Come to peace with our tears and discover what it means to be alive, to be at one with nature, a quiet teacher and a soft voice that guides, in memory, helping us to heal. This poetic message echoes the princess's own healing journey. In 2024, Kate Middleton was diagnosed with cancer following abdominal surgery. She was admitted to the Oak Creek Cancer Center at the Royal Marsden Hospital for preventive chemotherapy. She announced at the end of her chemo in September 2024 and her remission early last year. In another symbolic gesture, she chose to dedicate her first official outing of 2026 to the carers and patients of Charing Cross Hospital on January 8th, the eve of her birthday. The future queen's message is accompanied by a caption in her Instagram post. The Mother Nature series has been a deeply personal, creative reflection on how nature has helped me heal. But it's also a story about the power of nature and creativity in collective healing. There is so much we can learn from Mother Nature as we look to build a happier, healthier world. See. According to an aide to the princess quoted in the Daily Mail, the video posted today marks the culmination of a deeply personal creative project for the princess, spotlighting humanity's long-standing connection to nature, as well as nature's capacity to inspire us and help us to heal and grow in mind, body, and spirit. The newspaper reported that the clip was directed and produced by Will Warr and was filmed in Berkshire, Cumbria, Gloucestershire, London, East Sussex, and the Cotswold. Next up, King Charles is transforming this historic royal home into a luxury wedding venue. Once described by His Majesty as an appalling risk of an investment, the 18th century manor known as Dumfries House will now host newlyweds in the coming years. This is by Orla Sheridan on January 9th. Much like the rest of the world, King Charles has returned to work following the festive break. Having arrived back in London yesterday evening, His Majesty's first order of business is perhaps an unexpected one, a move into the luxury wedding market. Dumfries House, home to the King Foundation, is set for a splashy $8.7 million renovation in order to host more large-scale events, including the nuptials of newlyweds seeking the royal wedding treatment. This development will faithfully extend the 300-year-old house's east wing, using locally sourced materials and creating a 4,600-square-feet public hall suitable for events of up to 200 guests. The charity says it wants to become the go-to venue for high-end luxury weddings and private events, both nationally and internationally. Planning to host its first newlyweds in July 2027, the new venue will be named the King's Hall in honor of King Charles. Set on 2,000 acres in Ayrshire, the residence was built between 1754 and 1759 for William Crichton Dalrymple, 5th Earl of Dumfries, with Robert Adam as the lead architect. It was then extended in 1890 by Robert Weir Schultz, and in a more than $60 million deal, the house and all of its contents were bought for the foundation with the king's help in 2007. It was a big financial gamble. Indeed, at the time of the purchase, the then Prince of Wales admitted the decision was an appalling risk, but explained that the restoration project was as much about bringing life to the people and local community as it was about reinvigorating the estate itself. The physical renewal helps the spiritual and psychological, now King Charles said at the time. Over the next 10 years, the house's unique collection of Thomas Chippendale furniture was painstakingly restored, while the dilapidated Scottish estate was brought back to its former glory under the hands-on guidance of its royal patron. Camera crews were there to capture the transformation, resulting in an hour-long documentary titled A Royal Grand Designed, which aired on ITV in 2022. Narrated by Oscar-nominated actor Richard E. Grant, the documentary included footage of the king overseeing every element of design, from advising the best source for a favored type of Belgian brick to agonizing over the fate of a 300-year-old sycamore on the grounds. He hailed the successful restoration project as proof that heritage-led regeneration works every time, adding, "I knew if we hadn't stepped in and saved it, somebody would have bought it and they had a great idea, you know, for golf courses and things," King Charles said in the documentary, "and it would have never worked, so it would have joined the list of yet more derelict country houses." The documentary special was filmed before Charles acceded to the throne and offers a glimpse of him off-duty in a way that may no longer exist in his new era. Yet his desire to continue in a similar vein was clear. "That's my problem. I'm perfectly overambitious and long to use this model in other parts of the country," the future king says on camera. "I hope there will be another project fairly soon, which could be quite large. I haven't given up yet. Watch this space," as they say. Watch this space, indeed. We're going to segue into the politics section with an article about Russia. In Putin's homophobic Russia, watching heated rivalry is an act of rebellion and hope. The explicit hockey romance is an enormous hit there, perhaps because its closeted Russian hero feels surprisingly true to life. This is by Mikhail Zeiger on January 7th. In the past month or so, heated rivalry became a major global sensation. What you probably don't know is that the show has enjoyed extraordinary success even in Russia, despite the fact that it is not officially available on any Russian streaming platform. On Kinopoisk, the Russian equivalent of Rotten Tomatoes, Heated Rivalry has a rating of 8.6. Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad, listed as the two most popular series on the platform, both have ratings of 8.3. In other words, a self-selected group of Russian viewers think Heated Rivalry is the best show they've ever watched. It's an unexpected turn, especially for a country widely known for its homophobia. But maybe it's not so unexpected at all. I know Ilya Rozanov, the smoldering hockey player Connor Story plays on the series. In fact, I know him quite a few people like him. I might even say that I have been him. Like the character, I was born toward the end of the Soviet Union, a time when homosexuality was still a criminal offense. My father was a military officer. I grew up in a society where coming out never seemed possible. It was always clear that being gay in Russia would mean being an outcast, being cursed, having no chance whatsoever. The fictional Ilya was born in 1991, a time when LGBTQ+ teenagers in Russia had not even a single example showing that a different, freer life was possible. Throughout the 90s, not one public figure, no musician, actor, or writer, not to mention athlete, ever came out. Though Russia in those days did have a few pop stars who were obviously closeted, they were objects of universal ridicule. They wore feathers and women's lingerie. They could achieve quick fame by shocking audiences, but they clearly had no intention of normalizing attitudes toward LGBTQ+ people by openly expressing their sexuality. Their concerts were attended mostly by older women. Men sneered contemptuously at them while teenagers used their names as insults. On Heated Rivalry, Ilya wears a peculiar Russian Orthodox cross, just as I once did. But for him, it is an accessory, more a reminder of his mother than a sign of genuine religiosity. That too rings true. Even now, Russia remains a deeply atheist society. The roots of Soviet and post-Soviet homophobia lie not in religion, but in the legacy of the Soviet gulag, where being a homosexual was considered the worst thing that could befall a man. A gay man in prison was an outcast, a lowered one, almost a living corpse. These prejudices persisted after the collapse of the USSR and still prevailed in the rough hooligan neighborhoods on the outskirts of Moscow, where I grew up in the 1990s. Back then, the situation in America seemed far from ideal either. I remember learning about the existence of other gay people from the American TV series Santa Barbara, which was a broadcast on a Russian state television in the 90s. The show followed a millionaire family in which one beloved son turned out to be a closeted gay man, a family disgrace that was revealed only after his death. For me, as a child, the message was clear. Even in America, it was better to be dead than to be gay. Things began to change in the early 2000s when the band TATU became a sensation in Russia and then across the world. They were two teenage girls singing about their lesbian love, and though the group was manufactured by a producer, Ivan Shapovlov, who cynically reverse-engineered the band based on the idea that the lesbian schoolgirl fantasy would have wide appeal, the duo eventually became the only Russian pop group in history to achieve any real success internationally. But TATU's global success would have had no impact on the life of 10-year-old Ilya Rozanov, just as it didn't affect millions of real Russian gay people. They continued to live with the conviction that they had to hide and look like quote-unquote real men, and that coming out of the closet was the domain of madmen and suicides. I was 21, still a student at journalism school in Moscow, when I decided to become a war correspondent. I traveled to conflict zones in the Middle East and in the former USSR for almost 10 years with one main goal: to make sure that no one would ever guess I was gay. I constructed a brutal, hyper-masculine image. Like my friends, I allowed my homophobic jokes, I dated women, I tried to suppress my true feelings. I found myself at war with myself, and that war lasted nearly a decade. When did Russia truly begin to change? Remarkably, it was just about when the story of heated rivalry begins. Ilya and Shane Hollander, played by Hudson Williams, first meet in 2008, shortly after iPhones went on sale and social networks began to spread across the world. Before this time, young Russians grew up in bleak, rough neighborhoods ruled by the street thugs. Now they were growing up on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, freely communicating with more people like themselves. And our liberation from the shackles of homophobia is precisely what pushed Vladimir Putin to start tightening the screws. In 2013, just 7 months before the Sochi Olympics, Russia adopted its first law against so-called LGBTQ+ propaganda. It barely felt at the time. I remember Moscow in the 2010s seeming like the queer capital of Eastern Europe as gay clubs multiplied and Grindr's popularity rose. No celebrity in the country could afford to come out, but many gay people I knew, artists, musicians, athletes, insisted that openness was unnecessary, that it was perfectly possible to live freely and love whomever you wanted without displaying your feelings publicly. Happiness loves silence, they told themselves. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about heated rivalry in Russia. Meanwhile, Russian propaganda was gaining momentum. It increasingly claimed that the West was degenerating and had abandoned its spirituality, that the world was ruled by a gay mafia, and that Russia stood guard over traditional values. In Chechnya, a region in southern Russia with a predominantly Muslim population, authorities launched an open hunt for gay men. Police rounded them up and tortured many of them, with some being killed. The work of Russian journalists, my colleagues, spurred a campaign to defend LGBTQ+ people in Chechnya, with activist groups trying to help them secretly leave the region in order to survive. In 2022, Russia launched its war against Ukraine and adopted yet another repressive law against LGBTQ+ people. Coming out in Russia can now land you in prison. It was then that I, already a well-known writer in Russia, made my own coming out. After leaving the country, I married my boyfriend and wrote about it on social media. I became perhaps the first public figure in Russian history to enter into a same-sex marriage, and this became headline news for propaganda channels. Putin's television called me and my husband Satanists and said that Russia was waging war in the Ukraine against people like us. But I know that after my coming out, I received thousands of messages on social media, the vast majority from members of the Russian LGBTQ plus community. 99% of all the messages I received were words of gratitude. A very revealing sociological survey from 2021 shows that contemporary Russian attitudes toward homosexuality suffer from a monstrous generation gap. Among respondents over the age of 55, people of the Soviet generation, more than 60% believe that gays should not enjoy equal rights. Respondents under 25, let's call them Ilya Rozanov's generation, hold a completely different view. 55% of them support equal rights, seemingly including the legalization of same-sex marriage. Of course, even now, no Russian celebrities will say this out loud, even those who live in the West, especially athletes. In 2023, when the NHL attempted to run a campaign in support of the LGBTQ plus community, Russian hockey players were among those who did not want to participate in the effort. One after another, several Russians refused to wear the symbolic rainbow. It began with the Philadelphia Flyers defenseman Ivan Provorov. He was supported by Denis Gurianov, then of the Montreal Canadiens, and Andrei Kuzmenko, then of the Vancouver Canucks. In the end, some clubs chose not to clash with their players and abandoned the wearing of pride-themed warm-up jerseys altogether. Last year, shortly before the release of Heated Rivalry, the band TATU, which had only done a handful of one-off performances in the last decade, decided to resume touring. This time, however, its two members have been doing everything possible to distance themselves from their former image, pretending that the lesbian era of their lives never happened. They are never performing the Russian version of their original hit song, All the Things She Said, which speaks even more explicitly about the same-sex relationship between two girls. Living in America and following developments in Russia is often heartbreaking. My mother, like Ilya's father, suffered from dementia and died last year. I had no chance to travel and say goodbye. I am persona non grata in my own country. At the same time, the Russian authorities invented the idea that there exists a clandestine global network called the LGBT Movement and designated said network as an extremist organization on par with terrorist group Al-Qaeda. When state news talks about this extremist organization, it sometimes shows my photograph. I know that thousands of gay men in Russia have watched Heated Rivalry, on pirate sites, of course, because they have no legal way to watch the series. The Russian authorities would undoubtedly ban the show as LGBTQ plus propaganda, but most Western platforms don't function in Russia either. As a result, Russian queer people have to break every possible law simply to live in the same world as members of their own community. Heated Rivalry resonates so strong with me, a gay man from Russia, because Connor's story's Ilya does not look like an alien or a caricatured Russian gangster in a fur ushanka, the kind of Russian you typically find in Hollywood films. He is simply a human being, traumatized by a difficult childhood, yes, and trying to hide behind rough jokes, but ultimately just as frightened as his boyfriend Shane, who grew up in Canada. There are no exotic balalaikas, no mysterious Russian soul, no Putin, no Dostoevsky, just an ordinary person, alive and vulnerable. Many Russians I've spoken to are skeptical about the season finale's happy ending. They simply do not believe it, that the kind of courage shown by Francois Arnon's Scott Hunter, who becomes the first openly gay player in the show's fictional universe, or even the emotional openness of Ilya is possible. This is the psychology of a hostage. Such a happy scenario does not exist, even in their boldest fantasies. Many believed achieving such a thing is not worth trying, even though almost all of them would love to leave today's Russia. It is frightening and painful for me to talk to them. Like Ilya Rozanov, over the past few years, I have traveled an enormous distance toward realizing that freedom is possible. Even as Putin is once again herding hundreds of thousands of young people into an atmosphere of fear, recreating a society where coming out is impossible, and where it is once again clear that being gay in Russia means being an outcast, being cursed, having no chance whatsoever. Our next headline in the politics section, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey isn't sorry he told ICE to get the fuck out of Minnesota. This is by Aiden McLaughlin on January 9th. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey was meeting with his staff on Wednesday morning when he received a phone call from Brian O'Hara, a hulking former New Jersey cop who has served as Minneapolis police chief since 2022. ICE shot someone, O'Hara said. We've got two officers that are in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. Frey, who was just sworn in for his third and final term as mayor of the largest city in Minnesota, was holding a strategy session across the street from City Hall with his cabinet and council members. The meeting, he told me in an interview, turned into an emergency preparedness session to handle the fallout from the shooting. Video taken by onlookers at the scene would soon spread on social media, inflaming tensions in a city already on edge after the Trump administration deployed 2,000 federal agents to the Twin Cities this week as part of an immigration crackdown. The footage showed 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good appearing to reverse her SUV as an ICE agent attempts to open the driver's side door, shouting, "Get out of the fucking car!" As she began to pull forward, another officer fired through the windshield, and she accelerated quickly, eventually hitting another car and coming to a stop. She was taken to a hospital where she was pronounced dead. Footage of the killing became a grim Rorschach test for observers, who argued that Good had either deliberately driven her car toward agents or panicked and tried to drive away after reportedly receiving contradictory orders. A New York Times analysis of the footage found that her car appeared to be turning away from a federal officer as he opened fire. The Trump administration was quick to frame the tragedy in extreme terms. Almost immediately after the shooting, DHS Secretary Kristi Noem said Good had carried out an act of domestic terrorism. President Donald Trump initially claimed Good was screaming and trying to run over policemen when she was shot, though he appeared to soften his view of the incident after watching the footage during an interview with several New York Times reporters. Still, the administration's adversarial approach had by the end of Thursday been cemented. "This is classic terrorism," said Vice President J.D. Vance at a Thursday press briefing. "The reason this woman is dead is because she tried to ram somebody with her car, and that guy acted in self-defense." Frey, a 44-year-old lawyer by trade, known for battling progressives in his state over issues like defunding the police, had blunt words for ICE in his own press conference on Wednesday. "Get the fuck out of Minneapolis," he said. "We do not want you here. Your stated reason for being in the city is to create some kind of safety, and you're doing exactly the opposite." Despite the administration's claims that Good was a domestic terrorist who deliberately sought to kill ICE agents with her car, Good's ex-husband said she was a devout Christian and mother of three who had just dropped their 6-year-old son off at school and was driving home when she encountered ICE agents on a snowy street. Photos of Good's Honda Pilot at the scene showed a blood-soaked airbag and stuffed animals in her glove compartment. Our next headline is the first 48 hours of Nicolas Maduro's detention in New York. This is by Dan Adler on January 5th. A group of young men stood atop a jungle gym in a Manhattan playground, draping Venezuelan flags down the side of it and flipping middle fingers to onlookers. Across the street from the federal courthouse where Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores were arraigned Monday afternoon on drug trafficking charges, the flags could be found every few steps, and they could be purchased from an opportunistic street vendor. Two sets of protesters had formed, divided by police barriers, with one cheering the dramatic capture of the Venezuelan president and his wife and the American president who orchestrated it, and another objecting to the military operation on foreign soil that led to their capture. Cujo, a member of the anti-imperialist organization International League of People's Struggle, who asked to be identified only by his first name, took stock of a curious but fitting artifact of the moment, a double-sided flag with Venezuela on one side, MAGA on the other. "How's that for diversity?" Cujo said. Cujo recognized there was a contingent of Venezuelans on the other side of the metal dividers who were cheering Maduro's day in court out of discontent with the state of their country. but we want to be able to connect those experiences of invasion with our own, he said. One of his fellow protesters was passing around flyers. Free President Maduro and Celia Flores, the notice began, before offering a list of demands. End all sanctions on Venezuela. End all military, economic, cyber, and information warfare. Stop the regime change campaign now. Maduro and Flores are now being held in the Metropolitan Detention Center, a Brooklyn federal jail notorious for its poor conditions, as well as its high-profile inmates. In recent years alone, Sean Diddy Combs, Sam Bankman-Fried, Luigi Mangione, and Ghislaine Maxwell. According to Sam Mangle, a federal prison consultant who said he's been in touch with an employee at the facility, Bureau of Prisons Director William Marshall personally toured the MDC before Maduro's arrival, which Mangle described as highly atypical. Mangle has advised clients, including Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro, on navigating federal incarceration, drawing on his experience serving time for wire fraud. Mangle said that on Sunday, in the lead-up to Maduro's arraignment, the whole facility went on lockdown. It was one of a range of logistical challenges surrounding the arrest. Airspace was closed for U.S.-registered aircraft in the Caribbean this past weekend. According to Mangle's contact, Maduro is being held in solitary confinement with checkups every 15 to 30 minutes to make sure that nothing's happened to him, particularly in the aftermath of Jeffrey Epstein's suicide while in federal custody. He's going to be treated like every other high-security inmate, regardless of his profile, Mangle said, though he noted, I believe a lot of what you're seeing now is pomp and circumstance. On Saturday night, the White House posted to social media footage of Maduro's perp walk in New York. In Donald Trump's own account, the extraction of the Venezuelan leader had all the elements of a cinematic thriller. I watched it, literally, like I was watching a television show, he told Fox News. Afterward, Trump posted an image of Maduro blindfolded and handcuffed. Our next headline, Bjork has a plan to save Greenland from Donald Trump. After Venezuela, the Trump administration apparently has its sights set on Greenland. But Icelandic singer Bjork has a solution. This is by Kahina Sekal on January 6th. An American flag superimposed over a map of Greenland. That's the image accompanied by a single ominous word, soon, that Katie Miller shared to social media Saturday. Katie Miller is married to Stephen Miller, Donald Trump's deputy chief of staff for policy, as well as a national security advisor, and her post read as something of a threat. Greenland, it implies, is next on the U.S. expansionist list. Following the arrest of Venezuelan autocrat Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores, who are now appearing before U.S. courts, Trump has declared his intention to take control of the country. And the American president's entourage implied that the country's expansionist ambitions could therefore continue on to Greenland, a territory four times the physical size of France, but with a population of just 57,000, making it the world's least densely populated country. But one Icelandic woman has called on Greenlanders, who are technically Danish citizens, to declare their independence in order to resist American imperialism, as well as Danish government control. If we may have your attention, Bjork has something to say. On Twitter, the singer wished the country's citizens good luck in their fight for independence. Icelanders are extremely relieved to have succeeded in freeing themselves from the Danes in 1944. We didn't lose our language. My children would be speaking Danish now, and I burst with sympathy for Greenlanders, she wrote on Monday. The singer went on to talk about the history of forced contraception, where 4,500 girls as young as 12 got IUD without their knowledge between 1966 and 1970 in Greenland, linking it to news articles on the history and pointing to recent familial separations as proof that still today the Danish are treating Greenlanders like they are second-class humans. Colonialism has repeatedly given me horror chills up my back, and the chance that my fellow Greenlanders might go from one cruel colonizer to another is too brutal to even imagine, she continued. Dear Greenlanders, declare your independence, she urged, adding a map of her own, this one Greenland drenched with its own flag. Make Greenland great again. While he seems intent on riding the success of his stunt in Venezuela to keep the momentum going, this isn't the first time Trump has given the Danish territory the eye. In 2019, during his first term in office, the American president proposed buying Greenland, but it was rebuffed by Denmark. at the end of 2024 when he wanted to regain control of the Panama Canal and make Canada the 51st U.S. state, Donald Trump had already asserted it an absolute necessity to take control of Greenland. A few days later, his eldest son, Donald Trump Jr., visited Greenland with "my reps," in the words of his father. Trump told Greenlanders, "We're going to treat you well." MAGA, Trump wrote on social media, all in caps, "make Greenland great again." "While we are not for sale, and we will not be," replied the island's prime minister, Mute Egede, in December, "Greenland belongs to the Greenlandic people." But clearly unfazed by the word no, the billionaire now cites a national security situation to justify his desire for expansion. "It's so strategic. Right now, Greenland is covered with Russian and Chinese ships everywhere." On Tuesday, a joint statement signed by French President Emmanuel Macron, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, and Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen pointed out that Denmark, and therefore Greenland, is part of NATO, and that security in the Arctic must therefore be achieved collectively, in conjunction with NATO allies, including the United States, by upholding the principles of the UN Charter, including sovereignty, territory integrity, and the inviolability of borders. "These are universal principles, and we will not stop defending them. Greenland belongs to the people. It is for Denmark and Greenland, and them only, to decide on matters concerning Denmark and Greenland, the statement concluded. Our next headline, Kristi Noem's New York Welcome, A View from Inside the World Trade Center. This is by Dan Adler on January 8th. Kristi had a problem. 50 floors above her, as she saw it, her name was being tarnished. Outside one World Trade Center in Manhattan, she had joined a group of protesters who were chanting about a press conference taking place in the building. "Is Killer Kristi welcome in New York?" the crowd yelled. "Get out of New York, Kristi." From inside the tower, a different Kristi, Kristi Noem, the United States Secretary of Homeland Security, was addressing reporters about the Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer who fatally shot 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good on Wednesday during an operation in Minneapolis, Minnesota. On Thursday, Noem was announcing that the Department of Homeland Security would be launching Operation Salvo, which she described as a takedown of a Dominican gang in New York. She defended the ICE officer, saying that Good's actions constituted a domestic act of terrorism. Trump administration officials have claimed Good was seeking to run the officer over. "This is an experienced officer who followed his training," Noem told reporters, "and we will continue to let the investigation unfold and follow the procedures and policies that happen in these use of force cases." Kristi, the protester, who asked to be identified only by her first name, spelled, to her displeasure, the same way as Noem's, heeded a call from her church after the Minnesota shooting. On Thursday morning, she headed to Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan, outside an ICE field office where Noem's press conference was initially scheduled. When the location was moved, she joined a throng of a few hundred protesters marching the 15 minutes south to the World Trade Center, where Vanity Fair's offices overlooked a crowd swelling in opposition to Noem and a heightened security presence accompanying it. "I'm actually here to pray for her horrible, rotten soul," Kristi said, "and show my solidarity with Minneapolis." As the face of ICE's operation, Secretary Noem figured prominently into a vivid array of signs on display, along with drawing of red MAGA hat fashioned to read, "You're in a cult," and calls for justice for Renee Nicole Good, a woman was demanding, "Hag for Hague." The sun was shining on this unseasonably warm winter day outside the building, and a protest monitor from the American Civil Liberties Union kept a steady eye on the large crowd of police officers on hand. As marchers circled the building, passing by the reflecting pools placed on the footprint of the Twin Towers, a masked Port Authority counterterrorism officer stood in the shadow of Santiago Calatrava's winged oculus structure, holding a bundle of plastic zip ties hooked to a carabiner. In an interview with the New York Times in the hours after the shooting on Wednesday, Donald Trump insisted that Good behaved horribly and ran the ICE officer over. But when he reviewed footage from the incident with the paper's reporters, he sounded less confident. "Well," Trump said, the way I look at it, "it's a terrible scene," he said as the video ended. "I think it's horrible to watch. No, I hate to see it." As Thursday's protests, Michaela, who traveled from Long Island and asked to be identified only by her first name, described Wednesday's shooting as a tipping point. "This is a non-immigrant," she said. "Not that it matters whether it's an immigrant or not, but I think this just proves that everyone is in danger of ICE." She had brought a video camera along to document the protest. She connected what she was seeing to her own experience of the Trump administration as a trans woman who was in high school during the president's first term. "We thought we were done with it," she said, "and then just for him to come back, and it's even worse this time." Standing off toward the side of the protest was Murad Awadeh, the president and CEO of the New York Immigration Coalition, in dark sunglasses and a long trench coat. A staffer at the organization was leading a round of the most pointed chants regarding Noam. "This is the day after Renee Nicole Good was murdered by an ICE officer in Minneapolis," Awadeh said, "and we're demanding that her murderer be charged, that ICE cease the chaos that they are creating across cities in this country." That panic, he said, was being driven by this agency and this federal administration to deliver on a stupid campaign promise that no one really asked for. For all his complaints about urban decay and immigration in liberal cities, Trump has never fully distanced himself from the structures of cultural approval in his native New York. It's one way to account for his sudden Oval Office embrace of Zohran Mamdani and the mayor's telegenic metropolitan charms. Shortly after his stunning election to office in 2016, Trump visited World Trade Center to meet with the editors at Vanity Fair's parent company, Condé Nast. Before he walked away and lit a cigarette, Awadeh offered another way of looking at the protest unfolding beside him. "We're here today because Secretary Noam has decided to visit New York," he said, "and we wanted to give her a New York welcome." Our next headline: 5 years on, Democrats may be losing the fight over January 6th. House Democrats are fighting efforts from the Trump White House to rewrite the history of the riot at the U.S. Capitol. It's almost like trying to recreate 9/11 or Pearl Harbor with a positive spin, one member of Congress tells Vanity Fair. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on January 7th. "You should be put down like a dog, diseased fucking animal that you are," one man says to a police officer, according to a video captured by HuffPost reporter. Another man hurls slurs, calling the officers fucking retards, faggots, and the N-word. In another video, the first man tells an officer, "The only solution for animals like you is public execution." That man is Edward Jacob Lang, a January 6 rioter who was charged with beating cops with a baseball bat. Having received a pardon from President Donald Trump before he stood trial, Lang is now running for Senate as a Republican. He's one of a few dozen rioters who descended on Washington this week for the 5-year anniversary of the attack on the U.S. Capitol, walking free thanks to sweeping clemency from the president. "Your day will come and I'll be there for it," Lang told an officer at one point, according to video footage. "Look left and right when you cross the street, motherfucker." Nearby, in a packed room in the basement of the Capitol building, another January 6 rioter sat before a panel of House Democrats convened to mark the grim anniversary of the attack. "I'm a mother and a grandmother and a cancer survivor and a retired addiction counselor. I am also a convicted criminal for what I did on January the 6th, 2021. So began the testimony of Pam Hemphill, a woman known as MAGA Granny when she joined the mob that stormed the Capitol 5 years ago. The hearing was convened as part of an effort to push back on Trump's attempt to rewrite the history of the attack. Hemphill spoke alongside former Capitol Police officer Winston Pinjon, who described being punched in the face, pepper sprayed, and called a traitor by the rioters. There was a former prosecutor who worked on the cases against the rioters, more than 600 of whom were charged with assaulting or obstructing police officers, and resigned from the Justice Department after Trump offered clemency to those charged over the attack. That included Hemphill, who publicly rejected Trump's pardon, testifying that she did not deserve to evade justice. "I had fallen for the president's lies, just like many of his supporters," Hemphill said. She became emotional and had to pause as she described the start of the riot. "The police officers were heroes. They protected the Capitol and everyone inside the Capitol, and even people like me. I was trampled on by the rioters, and if it weren't for the Capitol Police helping me that day, I might have died." She addressed Pinjon directly. "I want the Capitol Police to know how truly grateful I am to them and how deeply sorry I am," she said, her voice quavering. I can't believe people are still disrespecting you and trying to lie about January the 6th. In the room, Congressman Steve Cohen dabbed tears from his eyes. It's easy to look at the anniversary of the attack and come to the conclusion that the fight for its legacy is one of the Democrats are losing. Out of power in Washington and impotent in the face of Trump's all-powerful White House, Democrats were forced to hold this Potemkin hearing. They called it a shadow hearing in the basement of the Capitol Visitor Center. Still, Democrats hope that proceedings like this, through footage and testimony, will ultimately cement the legacy of January 6th. The one thing that comforts me is that no matter what they try to do here, we live in the 21st century where people see things in real time. Representative Joe Morrell told me his office on Capitol Hill, "Those videos are going to be around, and so historians aren't just going to accept Donald Trump's twisted view of the world." Morrell, the top Democrat on the committee charged with security of the Capitol, has been pushing to install a plaque honoring police who defended democracy that day. A 2022 government funding law ordered the plaque to be displayed within a year, but Republican leadership has blocked its installation. "It's just bullshit," Morrell said. "I hate to say it, but come on, we're not children here." Eric Swalwell, who served on the original January 6th committee, told me he understands people are a little tired of hearing about that day. "The point of the remembrance," he said, "was to set the record straight. We are doomed to have another January 6th if we're not honest with ourselves and honest with the future. Our kids who have to learn from this about why it happened, who was responsible, and what we could do to make sure it never happens again." Less than 2 miles from the Capitol, a modest collection of the pardoned rioters assembled at the Ellipse, the site of Trump's speech that preceded the attack, where he told supporters, many of them armed, to protest the certification of the 2020 vote. The group that returned was not large. They appeared outnumbered by both the gaggle of reporters who came to cover the lurid spectacle and the moderately sized flock of geese that toddled on the grass nearby. Among them, Enrique Tarrio, who was convicted of seditious conspiracy and sentenced to 22 years in prison for his role organizing the violence. One pardoned rioter, 61-year-old Johnny Harris of North Carolina, held a sign reading, "J6 was an inside job." He declined to explain. Another man I spoke with, who gave only his first name, Sam, said he served 2.5 years in prison before he was pardoned by Trump. "We should get restitution for it," he said. "We did nothing wrong. It is our duty to stand up to a tyrannical government." And then there was Lang, engaged in a spat with Congressman Tom Suozzi, who had walked outside to engage with the protesters. "Our founding fathers would have dealt with you very differently," Lang told the congressman, according to video footage. "We were very reserved on January 6th. "These guys now see themselves as invincible," Swalwell told me. "They committed violence on behalf of Donald Trump. He absolved them of any responsibility for doing it, and it's essentially a green light to commit more violence in his name." In the immediate wake of the attack, the view that the rioters were victims was confined to the darkest fringes of the internet. The reality of the day was seen clearly by many at the time, including Republican lawmakers and Fox News hosts who now downplay the violence, and even the Trump administration officials who resigned from their jobs in protest. The day after the attack, Trump himself called it heinous and vowed that those who broke the law would pay. Marco Rubio posted on social media as the attack was being carried out, saying, "There is nothing patriotic about what is occurring on Capitol Hill. This is third world style anti-American anarchy." Lindsey Graham, famously and theatrically, declared on the Senate floor that he was done with Trump. Donald Trump Jr. begged Mark Meadows, at the time his father's chief of staff, to tell the president to do something to bring an end to the violence. Democrats aren't quitting the fight just yet. "I don't feel helpless because I have the last surviving lawsuit that Trump has to answer for what he did on January 6th, Swalwell told me. He's referring to a civil suit he filed alongside Capitol police officers, accusing Trump of making false claims about the 2020 election that fueled the violence that day. "I'm not giving up on that," he says. "I'm going to get that day in court with the officers to get our own sense of justice." This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, my name is Amy Smith, and you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks so much for joining me. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thanks for listening, and have a great week, everybody.